Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What did the men called to fight the First World War think and dream about when they were not actively engaged in combat? We have long relied on soldiers' letters and diaries and on journalistic accounts of the Great War to answer that question. And my guest today has created a visual record of one aspect of soldiers' lives, a vast network of nearly untouched tunnels carved out below the battlefields and trenches, places where men from the U.S., France, Germany, Britain, and other countries rested, cooked, planned battle strategy, and left remarkable evidence of their time underground. Jeff Guskey is a physician specializing in emergency medicine, and he is an explorer and photographer. You can see his work in the August issue of National Geographic in an article entitled The Hidden World of the Great War, The Lost Underground of World War I, and you can also see a larger portfolio at his website, jeffguskey.com. Jeff, welcome back to Think.
Thank you. It's great to be here, Chris.
How were tunnels and underground spaces used in fighting World War I?
They were the only place where people could find shelter from the mass destruction on the surface, and they were truly underground cities. These places were ancient rock quarries from which the stone for castles and cathedrals and fortresses were mined, dating back to the Middle Ages. So World War I comes along. Many of these places are right under the trenches, and they bring the technology of the day underground and create cities with rail and telephones and electric lights and hospitals and theaters and chapels and synagogues and food systems and offices, even street signs. And they were vast. One place I photographed was over 18 miles underground. Another place I photographed held more than 20,000 soldiers in one place with a 700-bed hospital.
As a physician yourself, can you imagine what it would be like to practice medicine down there?
It's overwhelming when I go there, because there are many hospitals. You still find surgeon sinks, and so I imagine scrubbing in with overwhelming war injuries coming in the door and having to keep these guys alive, and it's very emotional.
Is it quiet when you go down there, and what do you think about in terms of how loud it must have been when these things were fully inhabited?
It's very quiet and surprisingly peaceful and clean. The air is clean. It's completely dark. You literally cannot see your hand 2 inches in front of your face. But you walk, and you, as long as you don't step on anything that's dangerous, there's lots of live ammunition, live shells, places where you can fall into craters and pits. Beyond that, it's great.
Well, I think, you know, this is such a surprising revelation, and I'm no expert in history of the First World War, but I think a lot of people don't know that these things existed and certainly don't know that they've been all but perfectly preserved.
Even in France, these are all but unknown, because picture this. These are in rural areas outside little villages that don't want the outside world to come in. They're on private land beneath beautiful farms. And the French have a very deep feeling about preserving World War I. These are sacred places. So they want to keep the outside world out. And my good fortune was to build trust over time with local people who shared their secrets.
What did it take to build that trust?
The images actually are a language unto themselves. I don't speak French. Most of my friends don't speak English. But I would bring them underground with me, and it was almost instantaneous. The French have a very ingrained sensitivity to art and beauty and aesthetics, and we were sharing an adventure, a legacy-building adventure. And that was our language, and that was the bond. They felt it was important to preserve these places on film for 100 years from now.
Tell me about the first time you went underground. What were you expecting, and how did what you see compare?
I wasn't expecting it. I was at the end of a six-week journey, most of which was on the southern part of the Western Front in the Vosges Mountains in Alsace province, where there is a hidden world on the surface. It's an amazing part of, of France. And I'd almost considered canceling the last 2.5 days. French officials, whom were very helpful on this journey, introduced me to people all along the Western Front. And so I was I had a rendezvous with a young man who is the UNESCO World Heritage Program chargé d'affaires for this particular area. He's from that region, grew up there, has a lot of local contacts. So we go out to this place. I couldn't imagine what I was about to see. It's in a very remote location off of a farm field, up a big hillside with brush that you have to crawl through, and you climb over a mound. And what opened up was an underground city, maybe 9-10 feet high ceilings and wide in this case. It was very easy to walk in. And on the walls, it was a virtual art museum.
Talk about, so the photographs show a lot of aspects of life, but they're particularly focused on the art that these young men left behind. Some of it's terrible, but some of it's quite good.
It's museum quality art in some cases. The very first photograph I took was in this first place, and it is a beautiful classical Greek-like sculpture of a woman's face. I'm sure that there were many professional artists among the soldiers who came from all walks of life. And so they created a human world underground where they could feel and express and think and be human. You see dreams. In fact, there's one American inscription, carving actually, that is a pipe dream. It's literally a pipe. And above it is some smoke and a man's head who's dreaming.
I saw one image, and I can't remember which nationality left it behind. It's a galloping horse, and it's carved into the side of a rock face, and it's unfinished. And I was left wondering, first of all, I was left interested in the process of how you carve out of rock, but I was left wondering if it was unfinished because someone moved on or because someone never came back.
American. This is an American carving. They were there 6 weeks, and the back of the carving is unfinished. Chris, this horse is as big as you are. It's like 2/3 scale of a real horse. It's gorgeous. It bespeaks of American soldiers who, in my view, are trying to recreate home and the things that meant, you know, something to them. Sadly, when I went back this year, someone had begun to harm this sculpture. And so we are striving to protect these treasures. And this is an example of why.
So raising awareness about something like this, on the one hand, it causes people to want to protect them. And on the other hand, there are people who really don't care that want to go and interfere or even just trample through the site. Did you struggle with how making this work public might affect that?
Very much so. And so we're being proactive by asking people all around the world to get involved. And on jeffguskey.com, there is a page to get involved, to protect these treasures. And on Facebook, we're hoping to create a global movement where people can report treasures that show up on auction sites or in art houses. We hope to eventually bring Christie's and Sotheby's involved, get the French government involved. There are too many places to put bars over them, and they're on private land. Beyond this, the best way to protect these places is for the bad guys to get it, to be exposed. And we believe we can do this through a global community.
Do you struggle at all with the temptation that so many people have to find something historic and to take it home with you, or is a photograph enough?
I never had that temptation. These places to me are sacred, and we're striving to keep the places anonymous. We want these to be around for future generations.
Do the farmers and the landowners whose property contains these places, have they been through them? Because it seems to me if it were my land, I would be so curious to go down and examine everything.
Yes, but they they're such a part of their everyday life, they don't even think about them except to keep outsiders out.
Yeah.
And also, the places are dangerous. They're, so some of the farmers would go with me, but by and large, they just want them left alone. And they're in their family heritage. These places existed long before anyone alive was born.
What kind of gear did you take with you besides your camera?
We schlepped an underground, a portable portrait studio on our backs, sometimes through passing the equipment through little holes, just big enough for the body. If you go onto my website, you'll see me slipping through feet first into a very tight space where an amazing photograph of Hindenburg exists. And it may now be collapsed because it was so dangerous. I'm not proud of that, but I just felt it was important to get this photograph. So we learned to be efficient. My friends and helpers would help me carry gear, and so we were able to carry everything in. We brought a high-end digital Canon body and Zeiss lenses and 9 different lights with lots of light modifiers, and learned to make photographs in complete darkness.
Did you worry about getting lost?
Yes. The places can create some anxiety if you're there by yourself, and they're so vast. I only once went by myself underground.
And what was that? How was that different from being with other people?
It was a little spooky. Mm-hmm. And I used lights to, not lights, but these glow sticks that military uses.
Leave them along the way.
Yeah, yeah.
What about claustrophobia?
No.
Is that just you, or that they were designed in such a way that people wouldn't experience this?
Well, they're vast. I'm almost 6'4", and in almost every case, I can walk around without crouching. Mm-hmm. So they're not tunnels. These are truly underground cities. But sometimes I would reflect on, what am I doing here? How, you know, and yet there was such a, I feel so strongly about doing this work that I was cautious, but I forgot about the tightness of the space and the potential danger, and felt a very deep sense of meaning and purpose in capturing these photographs.
A lot of names are written on the walls, carved into the walls.
Hundreds. We had an experience last week that goes to the power of Facebook. It's amazing. I did 19 interviews on the CBC, which aired last week. And so in preparation, I pulled photographs from March of this year of Canadian names that I photographed in caves under a church on the Somme. Handwritten inscriptions. I was interviewed by Ontario, Southern Ontario Radio, and I read the name of a man who came from Omami, which is where the singer Neil Young grew up. A guy driving through Omami hears my reading of the name just as he's driving through this little village. He writes us. We post that picture the next day on Facebook. And oh my gosh, I literally had goosebumps. I can feel it now, the powerful feeling. This man would die several months after that inscription. That may have been the last record that he ever existed as a human being.
My guest is doctor and photographer Jeff Guskey. He shot the images for the August issue of National Geographic magazine's article, The Hidden World of the Great War, The Lost Underground of World War I. You can find his work as well at jeffguskey.com. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can send email to think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with courses in art, literature, history, communication, photography, and Portuguese. Fall registration opens August 5th. Registration and information at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with physician, explorer, and photographer Jeff Guskey. You can find his work at jeffguskey.com, and you can also see it in the August issue of National Geographic in an article called The Hidden World of the Great War, The Lost Underground of World War I. It shows underground cities that were built during the war and used by people on all sides beneath the battlefields in France. If you would like to join our conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372, email think at kera.org, or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. Jeff, I wonder about infrastructure in the tunnels and how much of that is left. There were electric lights, there were telephone lines. Was all that left behind when the war ended?
Yes, you often see the wiring, and you can distinguish between telephone and electric lights. You see evidence of food systems, plumbing, rail. I've even photographed light bulbs. No
wow.
Kidding. There is a photograph on Facebook, Hidden WWI, of an electrical switch. You see intact rail systems that go deep down. You see remnants, uniforms, bottles, shoes, implements of war, gas masks, even food rations. I found a clock that I believe was American, and it literally conveys the notion of frozen in time. The hands are frozen in time. So I found medical equipment. I found motorcycle parts. It's everything. It's like a time capsule.
Are these things continuing to decay over time? I mean, will there come a time when historians need to go in and remove things in order to preserve them, or can they be sealed off and just left to fully decompose?
This is a concern. Some places are amazingly well preserved because of the nature of the soil. They've been extant for 500 years, and they're going to probably be around for another 500. Other places are caving in part because there were fractures created by the bombs, and eventually they start to collapse. So it's hard to say, but eventually these places will deteriorate.
So to preserve the ones that are in pretty good shape now, what needs to happen?
I want to see a collaboration between Americans and French farmers to protect the American traces. You cannot believe how much is down there. Hundreds of names, notes to loved ones, emotional inscriptions. There's one, for example, of a side profile of an American face with a flag where the head is and a tear under the eye. He's missing home. It's an American flag. You see all nationalities. You see Hispanic Americans. I photographed a Corporal Gonzalez and a Corporal Sanchez and American flags. Everyone was so in love with America. They were very clear about America, and you can feel it. So I would like to see contributions and some type of formal arrangements made where there are protections and research. And I'm working with a group that shared their secrets with me that are dedicated amateur historians. They're called Soissonnet 1418, and they're really my partners in this venture, and they gave me exclusive access. And so together we will try to preserve as many places as possible. My personal mission is the American places.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Robert in Arlington. Hi, Robert.
Hey, Miss Chris. I really love your show, dear.
Thank you.
I just had a quick question for the professor. How were these built? And how, and they were to protect folks, right? So, and then how were they built without them getting caught? That was my question.
Imagine stairways from these underground cities directly to the trenches, where soldiers would appear on the battlefield and then disappear. And you often see these stairways. These places were ready-made for modern technology of the day to convert them to cities. These people were us. They They lived in high rises. They drove cars. They went to work on subways. They were inundated with mass media, just like us. And so very quickly, they were converted into underground cities.
And they, some of them started out as mines, as you mentioned earlier. So some of them were sort of retrofitted to be used in the war.
Almost all of them were mines. Mm-hmm. They were. This is what distinguishes them from tunnels. The tunnels were well known. The British have done a lot of work on tunnels, but the tunnels are mostly crawl spaces where you don't have living quarters, you don't have infrastructure. There's very little art in tunnels. They were offensive, whereas these spaces are large, vast. They're cities.
Is it surprising that people left things behind in these cities?
Not really. I think that they were anxious to come home. What's remarkable, though, is that the art on the walls is left for all of us to see now. And so they wouldn't remove that. They were almost a very intimate look into the inner lives of these soldiers who were defying the inhuman scale of modern life and holding on to their humanness. And oftentimes I felt that these inscriptions were a deep part of human nature that we all feel. We all want to be known. We all want to be acknowledged that we existed. And so when I looked at these in complete darkness with my headlamp, I would often imagine that they were saying, I was here. I existed. I was a living, breathing human being. I was alive.
There's a sort of purity of purpose to creating art that even then they recognized might be seen by a very small number of people. This was art that they were driven, compelled to make, knowing that it wasn't that they were going to, you know, necessarily communicate with other people or be praised for.
I think that the context was like when people are lost at sea and they put a note in a bottle hoping someone will find it, or a letter in a drawer that's found after 100 years, it's never been opened. It's a direct human connection between then and now.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Toby in Richardson. Hi, Toby.
Hi. Really, really interesting program. Your guest, I hate to say, some of what he says seems to be working across purposes, though. On the one hand, he's giving a great description of how spiritual and wonderful and beautiful these places are, but then on the other, and also at the same time saying that you know, they have to be preserved. People shouldn't be allowed to just run roughshod over them, or even really go through them. But then on the other hand, he's letting probably millions more people know that they exist, which obviously begs the question: you seem to be encouraging people to become curious about these places, and probably a certain percentage of them will want to go to them and see them. Yet on the other hand, you're saying that people shouldn't be allowed to. And the other thing is if you photograph them really well, if they're documented really well, if particular objects are preserved, what really is the point of preserving them for future generations if future generations are not actually going to be allowed to go through them?
You touched upon something that I think about a lot. It's a big responsibility to reveal these places. And yet, to the extent that some of them are no longer here, even since I began this work a few years ago, in 2012, some of them have been stolen or vandalized. So it's a double-edged sword, and so we're striving to keep these places anonymous to protect them because there's so many of them and they're exposed. And I have to tell you that it's not easy to find these places. So you can't just go. You might have noticed that I haven't mentioned once in the interview where in France these are, and I don't plan to. National Geographic was also very careful, by and large, not to give people clues as to where they could be found. People want to visit them, but the next best thing is to help protect them, and that's why we're asking people to get involved on Facebook, Hidden WWI. in reporting treasures that are for sale, that are stolen, that are vandalized. So I hope you'll become one of them.
When you found artifacts, did you have a policy for yourself? You're a photographer and you've done journalistic-like work, but you don't define yourself as a journalist. Would you manipulate things to sort of create a tableau of objects you found?
No, I have a rule set regarding my work that everything that is in the negative is in the print. So there's nothing photoshopped. What I do is the techniques that Ansel Adams would do, which would be to adjust contrast, crop, dodge, burn, to bring out the creative expression of the image. But beyond that, there is no manipulation.
Do you shoot in such a way, the images as they're finished are in black and white?
Yes.
Do you have color copies of them? Digital color copies?
The sensors nowadays all see color,
mm-hmm.
but I never want to see color. It throws me off. I don't think in color. So my workflow is such that I only see black and white.
How you said you brought a lot of equipment down with you, but you still, obviously, it was a kind of a limited kit, I would imagine, compared with what you'd have somewhere else. What were the limitations of working with lighting and getting exactly what you wanted?
Sometimes it took many times to create a photograph, ideally, because I'm striving for excellence. I'm striving to bring out the emotion that the original artist was trying to convey. Other times, in fact, as I've gotten more experienced, it's one shot sometimes or two or three, and then on to the next, because there's so much to do. There's so much to photograph, and in particular the names. I'm heartbroken when I pass over a name because it may be smudged or not readable. It's almost a feeling of responsibility that these men need to be remembered. So we've gotten better, but it still takes time and it varies. There's a photograph that was released today that the world has never seen that's very important. It's not underground. It's on the surface in the Vosges Mountains of Alsace province. On August 3rd, the president of France and the president of Germany will shake hands over the former front line as the launch of the centenary, which is a 5-year event, global event. And I found through friends of mine in an obscure location on the same battlefield where the presidents will be shaking hands, an amazing expression of humanity. And it took 3 different visits to get this. It's in a frontline trench, German, concrete, so it's perfectly preserved. And here is a beautiful plaque that's, I don't read German, but it says, from what I'm told, in very high language of praise, "Here lies a French combatant." It's on that spot, right in front of the trench, where a French soldier died and was buried. And there's a little cross underneath, and it's an expression of reverence. And when I think about the difficulty of that, was one of the hardest photographs that I've ever taken.
What made it so hard? Was it hard emotionally, or was it hard to do it justice?
No, the angles. I actually ended up doing a panoramic, believe it or not, because the trench was very, the spaces were tight.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was the actual logistics of the photograph of portraying this plaque in the forest.
Did your understanding of what you were seeing and what it meant, did it evolve over time as you went down into these places over and over and you saw different examples?
It didn't. I knew it right away on that first day, that first place, that this was a big story, and I felt committed to being part of leaving this legacy. And so it was, it wouldn't matter how tired I was. Like, I just got off of long shifts in the ER and had 2 hours sleep before this interview.
You're remarkably coherent right now.
Thank you very much. But the same thing in France. You know, you feel so enervated with a sense of purpose. And the people with me felt the same energy. It was like we were doing something very special for the future. And so that was it.
Your two careers would seem to have absolutely nothing to do with one another. And I wonder if there are, if that's exactly as you like it, or if they relate in ways that we can't understand.
They relate hand in glove. What I do as a rural emergency physician is to guide patients and their families on a journey from darkness to light towards hope. And it's a journey that begins with seeing, because the patients are in charge. They give consent. And if they are rationalizing or denying, let's say, a heart attack or a stroke, which often happens, you have to help them to see, to be sober. And we get to talk straight as ER docs. There's no political correctness. It's not right or left. We're not selling anything. And it's an intimate bond that forms with complete strangers in a split second. And it's sincere and sacred, in my view. What I'm doing with the photography is the same thing for more than one patient and family at a time. It's about seeing how modern life and the inhuman scale that we're all surrounded by affects our humanness. So the goal is, with these photographs, is to make World War I real and relevant. And it enables us to talk about ourselves in a way that's not right or left, which is very difficult to do. It's a conversation about what modernity does to our humanness. And this is what I believe Frederick Law Olmsted was all about in designing Central Park. It's something that we've lost, and it's so critical to saving lives and to retaining conscience in modern times. And that's what everything I do is about.
We're speaking this hour with photographer and physician Jeff Guskey. He shot the photographs for the August issue of National Geographic magazine article, The Hidden World of the Great War, The Lost Underground of World War I. You can also see his work at jeffguskey.com. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with courses in art, literature, history, communication, photography, and Portuguese. Fall registration opens August 5th. Registration and information at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is physician and photographer Jeff Guskey. You can see his work in the August issue of National Geographic magazine or at his website, jeffguskey.com. We're talking about a project he recently undertook in France, where he photographed hidden cities underground that were used during the war by soldiers on multiple sides. I wonder, Jeff, about similarities and differences when you found spaces used by German soldiers or French soldiers or American or British.
There were amazing similarities. They didn't talk about war. They talked about family and home and loved ones and sports. In fact, the American soldiers in this one particular area were all from New England. And 1918 was the last time that the Red Sox won the World Series. So inscribed in complete darkness, underground in this obscure part of France, is in big letters, Red Sox 7, Yanks 4.
Little did they know that it was more historic than they even thought at the time.
That's right.
A lot of pictures of women.
Yeah, but not very, very few pornographic. They're mostly pictures of reverence and of love and tenderness. And you see lots of hearts on both sides. And you see love notes like MH, you know, plus, you know, TD or something. Both sides. So the passion of the ordinary soldier is not about war. It's about the humanness inside, their interior lives, which kept them going in the midst of mayhem. And I dare say that we are them, and we would be doing exactly the same thing if, God forbid, we face mass destruction.
Were the American soldiers in the First World War of a particular social class in the way that soldiers tend to be today, at least those who were put onto the front lines?
I'm not aware of it, but and I'm not a historian, so I can't really address that. But I can tell you that most of the guys who did the carvings, the Americans, were ordinary soldiers, corporals, privates, sergeants. I didn't see captains and
not the guys
majors.
Who went through West Point or whatever.
Yeah, although I did see a medical doctor who, yeah, and so there is some variation.
What did he leave behind?
Oh, he just bragged about being an MD.
We have an email here from Kirsty who says, I'm an archaeologist interested in preserving archaeological sites and protecting them from looting and vandalism. I'm curious as to what, if any, response you've received from auction houses like Christie's and Sotheby's regarding the sale of World War I artifacts from sites you photographed. They are notoriously stubborn, she says, when it comes to removing lots from the market. So I'm wondering what you've heard.
This is all so new. Thank you for that email. We launched this this discovery. We released this to the world 2 weeks ago Monday. So we're in the infancy, but fairly quickly we hope to create a formal method on Facebook for people to join together in reporting the damage and the sale and the theft of these treasures. And so we hope that Christie's and Sotheby's will get involved. And if we build enough of a consensus, I would think that they would want to be involved.
What's remarkable about looking at these images is it occurs to me how much more distant World War I feels to us than World War II. There are still World War II veterans alive. Most of us who are adults today had at least a grandparent, if not a parent, who was involved in some way. World War I, it's not forgotten, but it feels hazier.
I believe there is a hidden world of World War I inside all of us. Now, that may seem like an abstract concept, but World War I was modern. And so we can really talk a lot about ourselves. Every time you go on the internet and you're bombarded with messaging, this is World War I. I mean, World War I was all about mobilizing millions and millions of soldiers who had no beef with each other to come out and kill each other. And they used advanced techniques of modern advertising and focus groups and slogans and myths and imagery. It's today. You know, there's so much that we can understand about ourselves. Getting back to your question, the visual icons of World War I, in my view, are on a subliminal level distancing. They reinforce the idea that this is ancient and irrelevant. When you look at the little white crosses on cemeteries and monuments and old photographs and silent films, these are all telling us that it happened a long time ago. It's not relevant to our busy lives. And this is what drives me to do this project, because this is so real. There is more left behind from World War I than there is World War II, far more. And so it haunts the present, and it's a way for us to really begin to think about the way modern life affects us. Because in my view, 2014, we've never been closer than we are to 1914, than we are today.
When you say modern life, there is new technology that we're learning to harness and cope with and understand the consequences of. There is sort of urban density and the idea of kind of living on top of one another. What do you mean exactly by modern life and how it haunts us and affects us?
It has to do with scale. It has to do with the incomprehensible, inhuman scale of the way that living in cities affects us and the way it gets inside us. We're all concerned about the way social media and tablet computers and cell phones are affecting kids and their social skills. And it goes to the very heart of what's real and what's fake. And it turns out, in my view, that one of the biggest responsibilities of modern citizenship is to discern the difference between what's real and fake. So we have to restore a human scale to modern life, because that human scale is what allows for conscience and allows for us to feel human, and that makes technology and the wonder of modern life safe.
It's striking that your effort to get preservation underway for these sites is centered on a Facebook page.
We've got to begin somewhere.
But I mean, like, is that an example of a technology that somehow is able to be used on a human scale?
Well, you know, I hadn't thought about that. I think that to the extent that people are passionate about preserving these places and really care, to the extent they're passionate about telling the stories of these soldiers whose names are inscribed in darkness on walls underground in France, that's very human. And we're connecting to lives who suddenly become real. When you look at the photographs that were posted on Facebook of Fred Mills from Omami, 4 photographs, and he's looking back at you. He's alive. He's a real human being. It goes deep inside all of us, I think. So I think there is a human, anything that makes us feel human, that creates real bonds between each other, a sense of social responsibility and purpose, I believe is how we restore human scale.
Is human scale the problem in a conflict like the one we're seeing right now between the residents of Gaza and Israel?
I think it is, because when you look at the way that problem never seems to be solved, this is because of modern incitement. It's using techniques of media and myth to overcome conscience. And this is the story of genocide in the 20th century. It's to turn societies into weapons. And this is what really interests me about this work, is for people, you know, there's a craving. I practice in rural Texas, and my audience, the people I care for, are ordinary people, and they have as much skin in the game as everyone else when it comes to terrorism and environment and issues that threaten our children's futures. And they want to get it. They want a language to talk about this. Everyone really cares about it, but we don't know how to talk about it. So I think that when you look at the worst tragedies of the 20th century, it is all about incitement and human scale and this intersection between technology and media and the numbing of conscience. We lose touch with the fragility of civilization and our own self-protective instincts.
Well, there's self-protection, and then there's also like introspection, right? There's this requirement, if we want to avoid doing these horrible things, we have to stop ourselves now and then and ask whether we're right or wrong, or whether in the right direction or the wrong direction. What is it about human nature that requires us to feel like we are 100% in the right?
I think we have to. Well, there's a very compelling draw or attraction to be part of a crowd. And so I think that, at least as Americans, we're compelled to ask hard questions about right and wrong, about conscience. And I don't think that America was created as a passive experience. All we received from the founders is that every generation had the opportunity to struggle, to ask hard questions. We've got to start asking hard questions again about the way modern life affects us. And we all are doing it, but we just don't know how to really articulate it. And it has to do with, very much it has to do with technology. And the very things that make life wonderful and safe and stimulating also make us passive and disengaged and living vicariously through others. And we've got to, you know, it all devolves upon these questions. What is real? What is fake? This is what World War I, I think, asks us to do.
I'm sure the irony hasn't escaped you that wars often lead to medical breakthroughs.
There you go. I don't want to go back. No one wants to go back. That's not the solution. We're committed to going forward, but we have to awaken conscience based upon creating a human scale where we feel we've got to it's so important that we feel human. When you in healthcare, for example, there is a resurgence of interest in hospitals to try to make people feel like they matter, like they're not a number. You know, like there's someone there to greet them, to shake their hand, to know their name, to sit. When I'm in a patient's room, I try to sit down and in a very relaxed way and have a conversation with them. Like there's nothing else in the world that matters but them. And these are these little interactions, and especially when there's crisis, when family rallies around and friends, that's all we care about. We don't care about material things. When life gets hard, we care about other people. And those are the bonds that make the world, make life worth living and make us strong to protect the future.
We don't have a lot of, context with regard to what was going on when people painted the caves at Lascaux. But I wonder if looking at these underground cities and the artworks left behind made you think in a different way fundamentally about art that's existed for thousands of years.
Yeah, I think that there is something about human nature and where we want to leave a legacy. We want to say, you know, I was here. So that's I haven't thought about it too much more than that. I'm not a historian, but I'm reacting to the raw human emotion when you see someone's name inscribed on a wall. What are they telling us? And when you see messages or poems of despair, you know, of praying to God, you know, with all of their hearts, you know, have mercy on us. You see that on these walls. And you can imagine what it's like when all of the superficiality of life is stripped away and you're facing the real possibility of not being here tomorrow. Life gets very real and you start to concentrate on what matters.
Do you feel fear? Can you bring yourself into that situation when you're down there?
No, actually, I feel safe. I feel peacefulness down there. There's on an intuitive level. When I'm in those places, I really feel like home, and it's amazing. And they're clean, and you don't find animal droppings or wild. You know, you don't find rats or other animals down there. After 100 years, there's nothing left to eat, I suppose. So, no, where I feel the horror is on the surface, and there you really feel fear, because you know there were. I won't even go into it, but when you read about World War I, there were horrible images of the scale of modern mass destruction where life would vanish in a second.
Chemical weapons, et cetera.
Chemical and these shells, the powerful shells.
Jeff Guskey is a physician specializing in emergency medicine, and he is an explorer and photographer. You can see his work in the August issue of National Geographic magazine and at jeffguskey.com. You can also find him on Facebook. Jeff, thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer with help on the phones today from Gus Contreras. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.